Welcome back to the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. This is Calvin Rosser.
And this is Steph Smith.
And today we're going to be talking about wealth inequality and whether or not billionaires should exist. So Steph, I'm weirdly excited to talk about this topic, and I want to kick it off with two stats. The first is there are just under 3,000 billionaires in the world, and they alone have the combined wealth of the 4.6 billion poorest people on Earth. The second is about the US, which is the top 1% of people have more than the bottom 90% combined.
Those are some pretty crazy stats. I think one thing that comes to mind immediately is just wherever you are in the world or whatever your circumstance is, you can only really see a little bit past that. You can only see a couple, I guess you could say, tiers of wealth, either below or above your current status. And so it is crazy to think about just the whole spectrum that exists of wealth, right? To be a mega billionaire and have more money than you could ever spend. But then also the opposite side of this, we obviously live in North America. It's hard to even conceptualize the other end where you're living on a couple dollars a day.
Yeah. I don't know if this stat is true. I think I saw it once, but I think Jeff Bezos makes something like $150,000 per second.
Totally insane. I think this idea that we'll get into of $1 billion is both such an arbitrary number, but just such a massive number that we really can't wrap our head around. If you spent $10,000 a month, which I think for a lot of people would be ample for 50 years, that would amount to $6 million. Spending $1 million a month would be $600 million over, again, that same 50-year time horizon. But if you were to spend $1 billion, and of course, this is not including any interest throughout that period, you would be spending $1.67 million a month, or that's $55,000 every single day. It's just crazy. It's hard to conceptualize a number that big.
Yeah, I find it hard to do that. And especially as you think of the multiple billions of dollars. But I think the interesting question is, like, what do we do with this information? What do we do about this? I've seen this idea circulating more and more online, almost that like billionaires should not exist, that they're somehow, it's unethical or they're evil, and the poor and the rising inequality is all due to these corrupt, horrible billionaires. And I actually have an internal backlash against that for some reasons that I think I'd like to discuss. But then there's this kind of underlying truth that so much wealth is in the hands of so few people. And what do we actually do about this? And what should governments do about this? So I want to just kick it over to you to see if you have some initial thoughts there.
Yeah. So I think I'm on the same page as you, where I think wealth inequality is one topic. Billionaires are another. They are definitely linked in certain ways, but one does not necessarily cause the other. And I think a lot of reactions of people is to come from the perspective of saying billionaires are causing this wealth inequality. And I think what would be a good starting point for us is to talk about what are just like the key arguments for and against billionaires existing. And of course, that's a simplistic question, like should billionaires exist? But I think the arguments for are pretty simple. I think I actually tweeted about this and one person caught my eye with their response. They said, consumers create billionaires. So really the perspective for is that these billionaires are creating products or services that people love. People are micro voting for those products and services. And if they're popular enough and providing enough value, then these people through equity and their capital in those businesses are becoming mega rich. So I think some people come at it from the perspective of these people are actually doing society a service. They're doing a good by providing these things and they're being equally rewarded for that value that they're providing.
And just to extend that line of thinking further, like just let's take a few examples. So Amazon, it's pretty hard to deny that Amazon has just changed the way that we shop and made our lives likely much better just as consumers. The other thing that it's done is it's created tons of jobs for people. Obviously, Jeff Bezos has been rewarded disproportionately for the efforts in building that company, but how many other millionaires were born out of just Amazon existing? How many people were able to ascend in the world because of this company that created lots of jobs? And the tricky part of this is I know there's like arguments against some of the ways in which Amazon treats workers in different parts of the world or the way in which they're treated in some factories and stuff. But you can't just take one side of this like company and zero in on that and say, oh, the whole thing is evil. There's lots of things that have come out of that in addition to the goods and services. The same is true for a Tesla, right? Elon Musk has now tons of money despite actually almost losing it all and like basically betting everything he had. But what else is happening besides people like loving Teslas and having a cool car to drive? Well, it's an electric car. Battery research has moved forward, and he has done probably more than almost anyone to actually fight some of the main causes of something like climate change. Yet there's the same people calling for climate change being the world's biggest disaster, saying that Elon Musk is this evil guy. Even I think in the latest bill that was introduced, they're not going to give these credits that they're giving for electric vehicles to Tesla because they don't have unions or something. And I just think there's this funny like hypocrisy in the line of thinking. Just to round this thought out, I would contrast those types of billionaires who were self-made, by the way, I think 70% of billionaires are self-made, with someone like the Waltons, who Sam Walton actually created Walmart and built that into a large business and became a billionaire. But that wealth has now been handed down for generations. And so there's now multiple Waltons who are billionaires. They were just given that money. That is very different to me than someone who has built a business and operated it and created on their own. And I think the way that we should treat those two cases is different. And just broadly speaking, it's the fact that there's many different types of rich people, including in the ways in which they use their wealth.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into the types of billionaires in a minute, because it's not just self-made or passed down. There are also a third kind of billionaire, which you could call a kleptocrat, which I think you could treat completely differently. And there's research to show how those different types of billionaires impact the level of wealth inequality in a particular place. But I wanted to get back to your point about the level of hypocrisy. I've tweeted before about things like just Jeff Bezos as a person, right? Ignoring the fact that he's a billionaire or his specific actions within his company. And people just have such a visceral reaction, despite the fact that they probably use Amazon Prime. They're probably tweeting about it through their iPhone. You get the point, right? So they're using these goods and services. And I think it's actually more intricate than just that, that they're using these immediate services. If you take something like an Amazon, not only did Amazon set up the infrastructure to be this e-commerce giant, they also provide AWS, right? AWS is this fundamental layer of software that allows thousands, if not millions, of other businesses to exist. So it's not just the immediate services that they're providing, but the infrastructure that allows innovation to spiral on top of that. So I think it's important to recognize the value that these innovators are providing. And then, of course, there's the question of what policies should exist on top of that to allow them to capture as much value as they are. So we can get into that after. But I do think that there is a very solid argument from the yes, billionaires should exist side, which is these billionaires, most of them, as you said, are self-made, and they've provided so much value to the world, which has helped us advance. And I actually saw one comment on that thread, which is we should have more billionaires, because if they are self-made and providing this value, I want more of that. I don't want less of that.
I think one thing that we shouldn't discount is that by Bezos and some of these other people being successful, they're also inspiring the next generation of like innovators and people who want to go create something valuable in the world and be rewarded for that. That kind of brings me to the question of when we say, should billionaires exist? It's not whether they should actually exist. It's whether or not we should allow anyone to have that level of wealth. And then how do you actually take away that wealth? You could go seize it from people, or you could have like really high taxes or other incentives. And so if you were to say that, oh no, billionaires shouldn't exist, what would happen is we would have to create a totally new incentive system that may disrupt the cycle of innovation that's helped make our quality of lives better. So income inequality is increasing, but our quality of life is just far better than it was 40 years ago on average and globally as well.
Yeah, I think the key here is, even though we ask the question, should billionaires exist? The real question is, should we restructure the incentives in society to reward people for the value that they're driving? And again, we can talk about the different types of billionaires in a minute, but really that's the question that we should be getting at. And then a secondary question is, if you were to restructure it, how would you restructure it? I see a lot of people pontificate and say, billionaires absolutely shouldn't exist. This should be a really simple exercise of wealth redistribution. And I really don't think it's that simple, right? It's actually a pretty complex exercise to change some of these policies, for example, through a wealth tax, where several countries have actually implemented this. France is one that a lot of people cite, and it didn't go so well. It's not as straightforward as just, let's just tax these people more and we'll get all this extra money and deploy it into the economy.
Just to add another component of that is just, let's imagine the theoretical world in which we can actually take the money from billionaires in some way. The question is, of course, like, how do you do that? But then the next line of thinking, which it seems like people don't actually go down, is then what? Like, does that actually solve the problems of inequality or the other things that are conflated with the existence of billionaires? Do you trust the government if you gave them billions more of dollars to actually then allocate that capital towards the people who need it the most? My answer to that question is no. And it's why I think it's ridiculous when people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren say things like billionaires should not exist. And I just want to read something from Bernie Sanders here just to kind of highlight.
Uh-oh, it's getting political.
Yeah, wow. The shit you don't learn in school. I guess we're not supposed to talk about politics, but it has nothing to do with the quality of Bernie Sanders thinking or anything, but it's the way in which some people think about billionaires. He said in a Democratic debate about billionaires, when you have 500,000 Americans sleeping out on the street today, when you have 87 million people uninsured or underinsured, when you have hundreds of thousands of kids who cannot afford to go to college, a million struggling with the oppressive burden of student debt, and then you also have three people owning more wealth than the bottom half of American society, that is a moral and economic outrage. He goes on to say billionaires shouldn't exist, basically, after that. And what I want to highlight there is just the number of problems that Bernie Sanders is now saying exists because of billionaires. It's as if billionaires created the student debt crisis. And it's totally not thinking about these issues as independent things or how you solve them, because what caused the student debt crisis? I'm not an expert here, but we had rising costs of higher institutions who didn't provide a good ROI to students, and their skills weren't a match for the labor market, and people got into all kinds of debt that they no longer could pay off. And the government actually had a pretty large role in this, as they have had with rising healthcare costs. So when I see these like types of arguments, I can see how you can get like really riled up. These people who have just so much, like how could they have so much when there's people who have so little? And I think that's actually directionally the right thinking. But to conflate the existence of all of those problems with billionaires, and then to say that adding a wealth tax then solves all these other problems, it's one of the most shallow lines of thinking that I could imagine, because it just doesn't actually solve the problem. And I don't personally trust the government to actually take that money and allocate it efficiently.
Yeah, I think just to add my personal perspective here, I would say, because we've gone down a little bit of the political route here, I am definitely left-leaning. I have been my whole life. I'm from Canada as well, so I believe in a lot of things like universal healthcare, cheap education. But I will say that something that I've realized more and more throughout my life is that there is a difference between the way that you want the world to be and actually creating that world. Meaning that I can wish for a world where we can tax billionaires and deploy that money effectively, but there are a bunch of kind of question marks along that way of how to actually do that in the very complex world that we live in. So for example, one thing that I see a lot of people misunderstand is they say, okay, yes, Jeff Bezos is worth X number of billion dollars, and we could reallocate that money. But that money is in capital. That's in his ownership of Amazon. And if he were to ever sell that capital, he would be taxed on it. So he is part of our greater tax system. And we can get into the fact that capital is taxed differently than labor. But the point is, it's not this like liquid cash that he has and he's withholding from the market. And then, as we've talked about, there's also the question of, even if the government was able to get these tax dollars from someone like Jeff Bezos, or the other super wealthy, can you redistribute it effectively? Where we've talked about, government isn't always super effective in deploying capital. I can just call on the Afghan war as a great example, where they spent $2 trillion. Can we just talk about this number quickly? Do you know the amount of money that has been invested in venture capital in the last couple decades?
The same amount, because this was on the All In podcast.
Yes, but I actually Googled it, and it's, I think, even less than that when I was looking at it. It is insane to think about how, when that money is funneled into the private markets, how it can be so incredibly effective. And of course, the Afghan war, I'm not saying all of government is as ineffective as that expenditure, but there is this question of, just because you can take wealth from the super wealthy, can governments effectively redeploy that? And what is the best way to redeploy that? I even remember asking some people who commented against billionaires on that thread, okay, so imagine that you have this wealth. How would you redistribute it? Would it be through government-funded infrastructure? Would it be through UBI? And they weren't quite sure. And it's nothing against them, because as an individual, I also am not quite sure. But that's the point, is that it's not as simple as just taking capital from one part of the world, the wealthy, and then redistributing it. There are many checks and balances along that way.
I want to add a few things here. One thing, just to double down on the comment about the Afghanistan stuff. So that's really complicated, because we enter Afghanistan after 9/11 to go find Osama bin Laden and defend the US and stuff. And so there was like wide sweeping support for that across political parties. I think there was like one vote against us going to do something like that. The problem is, as you mentioned, over the 20 subsequent years that followed, we spent the $2 trillion, which, just give someone some perspective on what that amount is, that's $300 million a day for 20 years. And I think it's really hard to say, was that a good use of money? And I don't want to talk about that necessarily, but I will say, what did we get out of $300 million a day going into that? Maybe in the best case analysis, it was somehow worth it. But at the end of the day, what do we have? We have a government who spends a lot of money, like obscene amounts of money, on things that they're not necessarily accountable for. There aren't clear metrics for the government to have ROI as you would in, say, a basic startup operation. And until we can have what I would think of as like effective ways to allocate capital and measure our elected officials against that, I wouldn't want them to have another $2 trillion. Although it seems like they'll just go ahead and find that anyway at this point. But I think that's actually a good example of, okay, if you give the government a lot of money, like what do they actually go do with it? And I'm sure people have different opinions about that, but that seems to be one where people are roughly aligned that there was a lot of money spent and it's not clear exactly what we got out of it. Just to pivot off of that and talk about capital allocation, if you take someone like a Bill Gates, a Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, they've just proven with their track record that they are able to build large organizations that provide value to people and that can sustain themselves profitably over time. And I think what's really interesting, at least about some of them, I'll take Gates as an example, although there's all kinds of wacky conspiracy theories about him. So if you believe those and are listening, not commenting on that and not interested in talking about that either. But he has the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which they co-run, and they give something like 3 to 4% of their wealth every year. They give many billions of dollars to this organization. And that's going towards things like solving malaria. And what I'll say is I would trust his $50 billion in his hands allocating it towards those things versus in the government's hands trying to give it to some causes, just because I believe that he would be a more effective allocator of capital. And that kind of goes to the question of, do billionaires give enough? I think on average, the top ones give like 0.3% of their wealth, but like the Buffetts and the Gates of the world actually give 3 to 4%, which is a significant amount of money, especially for those who criticize the rich for not doing enough. It's like, you didn't even give $10 this year. They gave many billions, and you could say that's a small percentage of what they have. They could easily just keep that. And I'd say I'd rather have those billions going into causes that are deemed effective.
And you also don't know their long-term game plan. They may choose to give a lot of that money away throughout their lives, but maybe they're actually holding on to some of that so that they can deploy it effectively into these really massive projects. One of the really important things here is that the reason that these billionaires who do choose to give back tend to be more effective in deploying that capital is because of the incentive structure. Everything comes back to incentives, where that is their own capital that they're giving away or deploying into projects that they want to see successful. The difference here is nothing against the government. I think it's very important that we have government systems and protocols to improve our society. But the difference between someone like Bill Gates, who's investing in his own fund that is going and trying to help the world, is that he is bought into that. That is his own money. Someone operating in the government is operating in this hugely bloated structure of which there is no direct ownership. If that money is spent ineffectively, it is not their money, right? It's not Bernie Sanders' money, even though he has great intentions. People in the government, you could liken to the way that people operate when they're working at a huge company. I can speak kind of from my own perspective there, where the mindset of someone at a 30-person startup is so different than one at a 3,000-person public company, because you're like, we got so much cash and it's just, we got to spend it and it's not my money, right? That I'm just less incentivized to make sure that something is done really efficiently. And the government is just like the extreme version of that, where you just have so many people spending such a large budget. It's not even a shot to them that they're spending it ineffectively. It's really the way that the system has to work to some degree.
That goes back to the accountability mechanisms. And ultimately, the elected officials, like, what do they want? They want to get elected every 2 to 4 years, and they have to do certain things to do that. They need to spend money on things that the lobbyists who help generate support for them need, and they need to win the favor of people, even if it's not a super effective way to spend money. And we also just don't have good systems for measuring these officials. And just like a CEO of a public corporation optimizes towards like quarterly performance, unless they're able to really shake that and think long-term, because investors will leave them if they don't, then elected officials do the same thing. Why do they care what happens 100 years from now? They only care about like the next election. And I will say, just like we talk about, we don't know what billionaires are planning into the future. There is something called the Giving Pledge, where 200 plus of the wealthiest people in the world, they basically have signed an agreement where they're going to give away most of their wealth. So they're not going to just hand it to their heirs or anything like that, but they're going to give it away partially when they're alive. I guess it depends on the person. And then in large part afterwards towards causes that they deem important. So at least some percentage of these people are planning to do that. And the question is that, you know, good enough? Or do we need to just give it to the government now and hope that solves the problems?
Yeah. And as much as I think it's wonderful that a lot of those billionaires have signed the Giving Pledge, and I think that's a wonderful thing for the world, I also think it's a little bit of an overstep to expect someone to do something, right? We can hope that billionaires are the type of people to want to redeploy their wealth to support the world, but they also earn the right to spend the money how they want. Every time a billionaire is created, at least again, a self-made billionaire, we all made micro votes to support that billionaire, and that billionaire has earned the right to spend that money how they want. Of course, they have to abide by the tax policies in their jurisdiction, but I do think it's important that if we believe in a capital society, maybe that's a question mark for a lot of people, then these people have really earned the right to spend the money how they choose. I also did pull up a stat about venture capital funding, and this just shows how effective money in the private markets can be. It doesn't always operate this way, but Crunchbase tracks unicorns, so companies worth $1 billion themselves, and they tracked around 879 private companies, which are valued at $3 trillion. Altogether, those companies raised $564 billion, which means they basically had a 6x return. And I don't think you can really point to anything in the government that has that same kind of 6x return, not just in terms of capital, but the impact on society, the innovation that was driven through that capital. I do want to take us back, though, because I know we've kind of come at it from the perspective of there should absolutely be billionaires. They drive so much value. But why don't we talk through a couple of these arguments against billionaires existing?
Just before we dive in, I guess I would say I'm personally not saying that, oh, billionaires should absolutely exist and it's fair every time that they get what they have or anything like that. It's more that I think some of the ways in which we talk about billionaires, we then conflate the existence of them with all kinds of other problems and assume that simple solutions like the wealth tax would solve all of those other problems without causing many other incentive-based problems and then not actually solving the underlying things. And I think from the policy perspective, that's where I always come from things is you need to solve individual issues. So wealth inequality in and of itself, it could be broken down into like 12 different large-scale issues. And I won't go into those now, not to bore everyone, but let's go for the arguments against because we definitely need to give credence to that side.
By the way, for people listening, Cal does have a degree in public policies. So he's definitely the public policy guy. But yes, let's jump into the arguments against. So some of the key arguments that I saw in people responding to that question, should billionaires exist, were things like, why should such few people have so much power? Other people saying that you can't really become a billionaire without taking advantage of other people or avoiding taxes. Billionaires shouldn't exist while there's still things like poverty or people starving. Some other people said, yes, I think billionaires should exist, but kind of along the lines of not the type that exists today. So others said that really teachers or nurses or doctors should be billionaires instead of tech billionaires, for example, today. Other people also seem to agree with some of the things that we've brought up, where perhaps self-made billionaires should exist, but inheriting billions should be treated differently. So those were some of the topics or ideas that I saw come up in the thread.
What I'm hearing in all of that, though, is it's not specifically about the existence of these particular billionaires. I think they become faces of this broader thing, which is I don't think the world has equal opportunity. And I think a disproportionate amount of that opportunity goes to too small of a group of people. And that means that the rest of us don't get to climb the ladder. That means that some people get to fly private jets while I can barely provide food for my family. And I think that's actually what almost people on both sides of the aisle could agree on, which is we all want a good life. We want equal opportunity. We want the chance to go up the ladders that we want to go on. We want to be treated well. We want to have security blankets within our lives. And I actually think where all of the disagreements come is about how we actually get there. Just to bring a little bit of like political theory to this for us, there's this philosopher, John Rawls, who's a very famous modern day philosopher. He's now dead, but he has a thought experiment, which is something called the veil of ignorance. And it goes like this. When we're designing rules for society, we should be ignorant of what social position we occupy within that society. And so in this case, Steph, you and I would take off our hats and we would not know where we would land in society. We could end up being, let's just keep it in the US for now, like in the bottom rungs of the US ladder, or we could end up in like the camp of Bezos. And then we design the rules of society based on this perspective, which is we don't know where we would land. The idea that I think Rawls had, which some people disagree with the conclusion, is that if you were to actually do that and remove yourself from your current position, you're likely to lead to more like liberal policies that provide a larger social blanket. You probably wouldn't think it's okay that some people are sleeping on the streets homeless. You wouldn't think it's okay that some people are underinsured. These are the things that like Bernie Sanders is talking about when he's talking about billionaires, which I have to give the guy credit for calling out these real problems. I have a problem with the identified cause of those problems, which I don't think is billionaires. Point being, if we come at it from this veil of ignorance, would we design a society in which billionaires could exist? What do you think?
So I think this is a really good theoretical structure for coming at a problem. But again, the more I learn about society throughout my life, I realize that what I want to exist can't always exist, or it's very hard. It's not as simple to just say, I want to draw this beautiful picture of the world and let's make it happen. Because we're operating with 7 billion people across very different economies, different countries, different values. And so it's not as simple as just saying we should all be equal, because that would be a wonderful society if we were all equal. But you have to think about not just where we are today, but also where we want to go. So getting back to the thought experiment, one of the things that comes to mind is, what is the time horizon of this thought experiment? And the reason I'm asking this is because if my goal today is to make sure that we're all equal, the incentive structure that exists to make everyone equal is really not the same incentive structure that you'd want to drive progress over time. So for example, if I'm solving for the fact that no one would be homeless today, that's focused so much on today and driving resources around that and not driving resources around what we can build tomorrow. Of course, there's a balance here, right? You don't want to destroy everyone's lives today in order to have this incredible future. But there is this question, as we've talked about, of incentives, where the reason that a capitalist society tends to be the most innovative is because it incentivizes people. It rewards them for driving that progress. And instead, if you're not really incentivizing a gap, that's really what you're doing. You're saying, hey, I'm giving you this extra money for the value you're driving. If you're not providing that, then you may develop a great society today for the people living in it, but that society won't really progress. So the question that I'm really getting at is, how much are you optimizing for today versus the progress of your society over time?
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're basically saying if we just wanted to make the world more equal today, and I think that actually gets dicey. What is equal? Is it equal amounts of money? Is it equal whatever? There's all kinds of ways in which we can measure equality, but let's just say we have a general definition we agree on, and there is basically a fixed pie of resources, and we could go and then allocate that in a more equal fashion, or at least one that is like less blasphemous than what exists today. Society would be roughly more equal. But if we do that, what we may be giving up are the things that make the pie actually bigger that could increase the quality of life of everyone over time. I think that's maybe, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it just reminds me of something we've talked about on the podcast before, which is that in the 1800s, a billionaire would actually be worse off than someone middle class today. And I think that is driven through incentives. And even though those incentives can cause a bigger delta between people, it collectively drives society.
Yeah, we certainly don't want to take away the incentives to innovate and to make the quality of lives of people better. And the reality is at least some part of that incentive for people, of course, there's like maybe some pure philanthropist out there, but is to profit from it. And I think it's totally okay if someone goes and does something that people want, unless it's unethical or something like this, and they end up generating large scale wealth from that. The question is more, is there a better balance maybe that we could strike? Before we get to that, actually, I want to comment on something which you said. I think a lot of people who will say things like, oh, just tax the rich or billionaires shouldn't exist, the type of thinking that you're engaging with there, from my perspective, is more oriented towards zero-sum thinking. Like for you to say that, you almost have to, on some level, think that the rich are getting richer at the expense of the poor or the less rich. And I think that's certainly true in some cases, but it's not as true as a lot of people may think. Just going back to the Amazon example, Amazon gave us access to a bunch of services and goods at like a lower cost, but it also allowed, again, many other people to build businesses that were on top of that. Think about all the FBA businesses where people have made a lot of money and improved the quality of their lives and then ship products to more people. There's just this whole innovative ecosystem where a lot of people have benefited from the existence of that company, including the people who are now getting goods at a lower cost. And one example I always like to provide, like for anyone who shits on these like big companies and says we should go to mom and pop shops again, like sure, local is cool. And I think it's awesome to support that if you want to, but would you want to pay 5 times more for every good in service that you currently have? Because you may end up actually paying that type of delta if the supply chains were not set up for these people who have economies of scale and such. Not only would I not want to pay that much more, but the quality of my life would be worse if, say, income opportunities were roughly similar, but prices were 4 times more.
Yeah. And by the way, one really important aspect of this whole conversation is that I think people have a visceral response to billionaires today because of the mega billionaires. What I mean by this is they see someone like Jeff Bezos and he has almost $200 billion. And they're like, that is just way too much, right? If he had 1 billion, I don't think people would have such a problem with it. But there's actually not that many mega billionaires out there. So a mega billionaire is, I think, considered to be 30 billion or more. And only 1% of billionaires are mega billionaires. But I think the reason that it drives this emotional response is because, again, they're like, someone should not have this much money. But the reason that they have this much money is really that most, if not all, of these mega billionaires have created their wealth through technology. So in the past, the mechanisms were no different. The Vanderbilts or the Rockefellers, they built their wealth through creating infrastructure. In their days, it was something like a railroad. Today, it's through something like a Facebook or an Amazon. But the reason that these mega billionaires today have amassed so much wealth is because they have that leverage through software, which someone 100 years, 200 years ago didn't have. I think it's just important to keep that in mind. And to add a couple other examples, China and India have similarly amassed a ton of billionaires over the last couple decades. And that's because those billionaires, not all of them, but many of them have helped build this thriving economy versus at least what it was before. In 1978, China had zero billionaires. Now it has the second most billionaires in the world. And that is partially maybe through some corruption, but I think largely through the thriving economy that has been built in that country.
It's undeniable that technology and how everything has become more connected and you have higher leverage has enabled the proliferation of billionaires. And as you mentioned a couple of times, the billion number is just so arbitrary. It's just a big number. I think that's the point. Is 100 million too much? I would say, actually, just from my personal experience, I went to school at Princeton and there's lots of wealthy people. And that was very different from my background. I had a mom who made less than $15,000 a year. And so I get to Princeton and there's all these people who just, they have these like beautiful salmon colored shorts that I want and like all these things that I want and just can't have. And that may seem silly, but it wasn't just that they had kind of material items. They also had way better schooling than I did. I had like people in my direct friend group, their parents would actually read like their Princeton essays and their parents were smart and were able to help them. So they had these like inbound advantages at this school where in the beginning I was like struggling as this like poor kid trying to rise up through the world. And I think actually what gets me a little bit more irritated than billionaires is this whole group of people who has many tens of millions, let's say, and there's not an exact number, but they collectively have a ton of the like kind of power and influence, I think, including over the discussion about politics, and have children who just have so much more opportunities than the average person. And so I think it's really interesting to see people backlash at billionaires when there's this other class, maybe you could call it the 1%, which I don't think is very in favor either, but where the advantages even at that level are pretty great. And the question becomes like, how do you move more people towards that rung of the ladder? And does that mean that you need to push other people down?
I think it gets back to this idea of how do we give people equal opportunity? And does that really come from taking more from the rich? I'm not sure. But I also think that UBI, for example, has been a very pertinent topic recently. And I heard Naval talk about this on his podcast with Joe Rogan. What about UBS, which would, instead of universal basic income, it's universal basic services. So that is not really so different to what you in some socialist societies, where you get free education, free healthcare, but you also maybe get free things like Wi-Fi, things that actually support you, as you said, to get to that next rung of the ladder. It gives you a shot. I think that is a really important problem to solve. And I think even just education around how wealth is built is important. This actually relates to this conversation around billionaires, where if you look at the data of how most people accrue their wealth, it's through labor. Most billionaires accrue their wealth, unsurprisingly, through capital, right? So ownership and things. And even if you look at a lot of celebrities, most celebrities are not billionaires. But the few that have made it to billionaires are not because they're necessarily more talented. It's mostly because they've figured that out and they've held equity stakes in things. For example, Michael Jordan, obviously, most people know him. He became a billionaire through his ownership stakes in sports teams and through corporate partnerships. Tyler Perry is another example. Most people don't know him. He's not as well known a celebrity as a lot of the people that come to mind, but he created his own production company and he is a billionaire through, again, his equity in something. So even just educating people on that very idea of how wealth is created is something that I think can equalize the playing field.
I totally agree. And maybe we could just get to some practical ideas. I think we've covered the issue and layered on some of our personal biases here. But the more interesting thing is, what do we do? Like, how do you think about this in a productive way? And I'll say, like, unproductive thinking for me would be Jeff Bezos going to space and spending X million dollars on that for a joyride is like a massive problem. I think that's not a good line of thinking. Like, him going to space is not the reason that we have rising income inequality in the world. I think it's the face of this underlying discontent that people have. I think that discontent is fair. Like, it's fucking sucks to start from the bottom of the rung and to try to climb up and to not have the same opportunities that other people do and to maybe not make it. And it requires like tons of hard work and grit and all these things. And you still, again, may not make it. But I generally believe that the best system for allowing people to rise up through the ranks, like the American dream type of thing. I think it's ridiculous that people say the American dream is dead. I don't believe that at all. And I think the best system for just continuing to allow it to exist, and maybe we can increase the access of it, is capitalism. And the question is, what are the constraints that we put on the capitalist system so that we then invest in other people?
Let's talk about some of these potential policy changes. So one really simple one that people bring up is just a change in the tax structure. So labor income today tends to be taxed more highly than capital income. Most billionaires, as we've talked about, have most of their net worth coming from capital. So a very simple change that some people propose is just to increase the capital gains rate. Why should we do that, or why shouldn't we do that?
Oh, I didn't realize this is going to be a debate here where we need to go into these specific policies. What I'll say on that one, and just generally capital gains or wealth tax or any of this stuff, the more that you tax capital, the less capital there's going to be to fund back into innovation, at least from like the people who have that capital. And yes, more money goes to the government, but then you would have to make the assumption that the government is a better allocator of capital than the people that you're taking it from. And so what I think would actually happen if you like really boost these things up is, one, my gut tells me that wealthy people are going to find some way around this. And it may mean that they move money like to countries outside of the US. And it may mean that like fewer people immigrate to the US to actually innovate here because the rewards don't make sense. And we may have like partially a talent drain, but also a capital drain that could be dangerous. That's being a little bit cynical, though. I think some of the other things are, you may stifle things like innovation. But the biggest thing that I think people don't talk about on this type of stuff is, as someone who's like gone from relatively poor in the US to being much more stable, I'm not like mega rich by any standards. But when you create like higher tax structures, you're creating more of a moat for rich people. And it's because, sure, you may take more marginally from like the person with $100 million, but is that really going to impact their quality of life? Not that much, which is one of the arguments for taking more money. But if you take more money from, say, like me or person trying to climb the ladder, as we climb that ladder, there's no way that we can fill the gap. And I think this is one of the things that people just completely ignore in this thing, where you're really screwing some people who start from lower income places if you create things with low enough thresholds. Now, if you're talking about, hey, if you have over $100 million and we're going to tax 1% of, that's a little bit of a different story. I still don't think the wealth tax is necessarily the best. The final thing is, I just still very strongly believe that the government is a pretty poor allocator of capital. And I just genuinely wish that wasn't true. I wish that they had the right incentives. I wish that they could get more money to the poor. But as someone who like grew up within the system without much money, there was not particularly a large amount that was given that was helpful. And I think it's really tricky to do this right. And I don't trust the government to do that. And I'd rather have the people who have built like successful companies per se actually able to make those decisions on their own.
So let's talk about the wealth tax. That is a tax that has come up in my research as people say, billionaires shouldn't exist, we should tax rich people more. One of the solutions that comes up tends to be this wealth tax. There's a couple countries that have actually implemented a wealth tax. The one that tends to be cited a lot is in France. They actually, I think, disbanded it or adjusted it in recent years. But basically, it was called the ISF, which was an annual progressive tax with rates from 0.5 to 1.5% for the mega rich. So I think the threshold was that their net worth needed to be greater than 1.3 million euros for this wealth tax to come into play. Now, naturally, because it's a wealth tax, there was a lot of controversy, people taking different sides on whether it was successful or not. It was actually around for many decades. But a couple of things that surfaced as I was doing my research. One was this idea that, yes, if you implement a wealth tax, you're basically driving a lot of the wealthy people away from that place. Bernard Arnault, the CEO of LVMH, he immediately, when this wealth tax was implemented, looked for residency in Belgium, for example. So this isn't super surprising, but that is something to keep in mind, that there are 196 countries around the world. And as soon as you implement a wealth tax in your particular jurisdiction, you are increasing the incentive for someone to leave your country. And of course, as we've talked about, the ultra rich have those resources to leave the country. Just to add some numbers to this, I believe France changed the wealth tax in 2015, which led to 12,000 millionaires leaving France in 2016. In addition to that, it naturally also increases the incentive for people to lie about their assets or the income that they're driving. So in general, I think the key kind of con of a wealth tax is that even though you think it'll drive a lot more revenue, what France actually found is that it likely drove around half the revenue from the ultra rich during that time period.
Actually, one of the ideas that I hadn't thought too much about is if you have something like the wealth tax, like, of course, you need to consider the incentives. And then does that actually drive more tax revenues? And then things like, how do you actually operationalize that? For example, if we took 2% of Jeff Bezos' net worth, do we make him sell Amazon stock, which then he's also taxed capital gains wise, and then do that every year? It gets a little bit weird in my head, just thinking through it a little bit. But is this idea that for you to believe in the wealth tax, you need to believe that the government is going to be able to successfully collect these taxes? Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. One of the other kind of downsides that people, again, haven't normally thought through is if you are going to implement a wealth tax like this, you are likely going to have to hire a lot more people to enforce that tax. So if you're in the US, that's the IRS hiring a ton more people. That's more tax dollars. And again, the question is, are you actually going to get the number of tax dollars that you think you are through this wealth tax? It's almost certainly going to be lower than the projections if you were to just say, we have this number of billionaires and we think we're going to get this much from them. In addition to that, we get back to the question that we've talked about throughout this episode. Even if you get that money from the billionaires or the ultra rich, can you deploy it effectively?
I wonder how many projections include the tens of thousands of IRS agents that would need to be hired. And in fact, I think that's already happening anyways. But nonetheless, let's go to some new ideas because I feel like we spent a lot of time on the wealth tax.
Yeah, let's do it.
So we've talked a ton about billionaires, but what I want to do is talk a little bit more about just income inequality and some just basic ways in which we could think about tackling that via policy. I am not at all an expert here, and I don't think you are either, but I just want to throw out some ideas and just have a normal everyday conversation about them and move it away from this should billionaires exist type of thing. And so the first one, which is talked about quite often, is raising the minimum wage. So you see all kinds of stats that over the last 40 years, American productivity has increased, but the inflation adjusted wage has not. And it's like a third of what it should be if you counted for productivity changes. And so people backlash against that and they say, oh, the minimum wage should be at least $15 because you really just can't live. Let's focus on the US for now because going global would be too hard on the minimum wage. And so we need to raise that. Well, the people who are in like favor of this are saying that's going to solve all the problem and people are at least going to have a more livable wage. But then the people who argue against this, they're saying like, oh, what's going to happen is as the cost of labor goes up for these businesses, what business owners are going to do is they're going to reduce the hours of their staff or they're going to pass along those price increases to consumers. They're just going to make their products more expensive. And so the people who earn more income actually just have to pay more for products anyways, and it nets out to not very helpful.
Or hire people from other countries. I think the globalized nature of the world adds a layer of complexity to all of these policy questions. A good example of this is the apparel industry. I think I heard on a podcast recently that something like 100% of apparel workers work in more developing countries. This is not surprising. Look at any tag on a t-shirt that you own. But this is the exact kind of mechanism that I'm talking about where if you increase the minimum wage in the United States, wonderful. There's great intentions there, but you do need to think about how that impacts every single business owner who's going to be operating from the perspective of how do I run my business most effectively?
It gets tricky. I'm not sure exactly where I fall on the minimum wage, but I do think there's this balancing act between saying, hey, people need to earn more money and then thinking about the incentives of business owners. And I guess some states have implemented the minimum wage that's much higher, so we could start to look at the data there. But I will say that I don't think it would solve income inequality, but it may make life a little bit more livable for some, which could be worth it.
Definitely. And just to be clear, I also am in favor of increasing the minimum wage. I'm just trying to introduce different sides of that argument because I think for a long time, as I shared before, I sit on the left if you were to place me somewhere along the spectrum, and I had this really idealistic view of how things should be. Everyone should have access to public healthcare and education, and we should increase the minimum wage to X, Y, and Z. And I think over time, even though I really believe those things should exist, I've realized the complexity that is associated in implementing them.
That's an important point. I don't know that I would say I'm on the left or the right. I will say that I generally believe in good ideas and trying to understand root causes of problems and the potential solutions. But just a couple of more policies we can talk through. So one is, I think a big issue, at least what I saw, came from a relatively poor family. Some people are still in that circumstance. One thing that I see is actually even when people make what we might deem a livable wage, there are behavioral things that lead to someone not saving or not investing or not doing the things that you see wealthier people do. And wealthier people are not necessarily doing this because they have so much more. They're doing it because they've been taught by people how to actually go about and build wealth. So obviously in the public education system, it's rare to find a personal finance class that teaches people the importance of just the most basic things. And I know, at least for myself, I basically had to fend on my own. I had to go pick up books. I had to go read it. I had to go figure this stuff out on my own. Thankfully, I had the little penchant for it and have even been able to help other people with it. But I do think there's just a big education gap. So one idea would just be to invest in programs that incentivize people to save. So I'm a big incentives matter person. So an example of this, what if we had a federal match program for your savings or the amount you invest? So we have this a little bit with things like 401ks. It mostly falls on the company. But what if we had the government actually contributing to the amount that you save or invest via some special vehicle? And that way, we actually are getting money to people who are doing the things that will ultimately help them build a higher quality of life over time. And we also know that things like parental income are associated with better education and financial outcomes for children. And slowly over time, you build up people's income and their education, and that eventually passes down to generations.
I think one simple thing that the American financial system could change is the amount of credit that they give to people. I know that maybe it would be an overstep where we want to treat people like adults and give them the opportunity to make decisions for themselves. But if you go to Europe, for example, it's really hard to get a credit card. And the reason it's really hard to get a credit card, especially one with all the benefits that exist in a lot of American credit cards, is because they're not allowing a lot of people to go into the debt that funds those really impressive and lucrative credit cards. So there's all types of things that you could restructure. But again, to give the flip side of that is the ability to infuse capital into people or businesses really easily is also something that drives innovation. So I feel like the more we talk about this, it's always just this like double-edged sword, and you need to find the sweet spot that works for people within your society.
Yeah, it is with credit, but credit's an interesting one. It's a personal one where I remember distinctly my mom had credit cards in the freezer, and eventually she like cut them up, but it's because she could not control her spending and she made $15,000 per year. Like she didn't have any extra income to go pay off credit cards and carried debt over time. There is this balance between enabling people to actually buy things ahead of time and have that credit available, but also not allowing them to get into situations where it's so impossible to get out. And then you go get payday loans and then you can never pay those off. And then you're just in this, it's the cycle of poverty. You end up getting screwed. And this is pretty well established in the literature. And I think where people vary is the degree to which they put the responsibility on the individual. So if you were like on the very far right, you say like every person for themselves. And on the left, it's we need to protect this person. That's like an oversimplification. At the end of the day, it's like some mix between relying on the person themselves and then also creating safeguards where they're not getting into situations where you can't climb out of the hole.
Exactly.
So another idea I want to just throw around with you is one way in which there's a big difference between, say, the wealthy and the not wealthy is the wealthy typically own things and the not wealthy rent them. You could think about that with like time, but you can also think about it with things like housing. What we have right now is like the housing market is booming. I think one of the reasons it's booming is because there's a housing shortage in a lot of places. There just simply aren't enough homes. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. One may be it's actually hard to get permits to go build homes and to get the right zoning to go build more things. And so there's just not enough supply for the demand. And who benefits from this? It's certainly not the people who are renting, because the people who are renting, their rent goes up and they're not actually building ownership in that thing. They're just sending more money down the drain. But the people who own homes, their assets are appreciating. So I guess the suggestion is finding ways to make housing more affordable. And so that could come through like government subsidies that actually help people, maybe the renters, or programs that help people buy homes. So we've seen that can go really wrong if we take that to the extreme with the 08 crisis. But at the same time, it may be governments actually facilitating the building of more homes so that supply constraints aren't actually a reason for housing prices to go up. And as more supply comes into the market, maybe prices will come down and more people can actually afford a home and build ownership. What do you think?
I think it's an interesting perspective. As I was doing research for the episode, there was this graph from the Netflix Explained episode on billionaires, and it just showed how there is this switch at a certain point when you get wealthier, where earlier on, a lot of your income comes from labor, and then that switches to capital income. So it's an interesting perspective to consider. How do we get people on that train of getting wealth through capital allocation instead of labor allocation earlier on in their lives. And I think there are some interesting changes there where even there's now fractional ownership of homes, for example. So there's a lower barrier to entry. You're seeing a lot more people, especially in the last year or so, get involved in the capital markets, the public markets, owning stocks that hopefully will appreciate throughout time. So I think it is an interesting perspective where we mentioned even earlier in the episode, just giving people the education so that they know that most wealth comes from capital, not labor, and introducing them to that and democratizing their ability to participate, whether it's through housing or stocks or even starting their own company.
Yeah, we can certainly do more on that front. And fingers crossed for everyone who's gotten involved in the public markets and is making bets. I hope they pay off. Let's just cover a few more ideas. This one's kind of broad, but I think some ways in which we can support investments in education. So the other day, I was just walking down the street after a surf and I was feeling really good. And I was just struck by this like lightning bolt of gratitude. And what hit me, which hadn't for a long time, is that I was actually able to go to Princeton, which is like $250,000 for 4 years, completely free. And the reason for that is they base the amount you pay based on your parents' income. And so they have this really progressive system where if you don't have money, you don't really have to pay for the education. And if you come out of Princeton, maybe some people would disagree with this, but if you really wanted to, you could get a job that gave you six figures almost immediately out of college. And some people choose not to do that. The opportunities that you get from a school like that are actually quite large, regardless of what you may think about that group of people, et cetera. I was just thinking about this. I climbed this like socioeconomic ladder. And so some of it was like luck, some of it was hard work. And then a big part of catapulting into the next stage of that and learning from people who knew what to do to keep climbing that ladder and to keep fighting that fight was getting to this educational experience. The other thing was not being saddled with $250,000 in debt after that experience. And so student debt is like a big thing talked about in the US. Lots of people go to school, they don't have good ROI on that education, and then they have tons of debt afterwards. I didn't have that, and it enabled me to keep moving up the ladder in a way that was more sustainable. And I think just we need to rethink the way in which we invest in people's education, including earlier on, to help them figure out what are the opportunities that actually exist based on where you go to school, so you can make wiser decisions than, say, an 18-year-old who's just throwing darts at a map and figuring out where the cool place is to go party and then not thinking about the 200K in debt that they're going to end up in after that.
The amount of debt that students end up with in the US is insane. I also was in debt after university, but in Canada, the pricing structure is just a little more reasonable than the United States. So I was in engineering. I paid, I think, around $10,000 to $12,000 a year, Canadian dollars as well. And so I ended up also getting quite a few bursaries and grants based on my parents' income. But I ended up graduating with $30,000 in debt, which is a lot more reasonable. That's something you can actually pay off within even a year or a couple years if you get a decent job. So the thought of being hundreds of thousands in debt is just insane. And you can take the kind of more social structure of education even further. I lived in Sweden for a year. They actually pay students to go to school. Not a ton, but every student going through higher education got paid $500 or so per month to be at school. And then you actually saw people stay in school for longer as well. Instead of taking degrees for 4 years, they were taking them for 6-7 years and learning for longer. So that was an interesting result of that system. One thing that I also noticed about the American system is the idea that most schools are applauded based on their low acceptance rates. And the same thing is true to a degree in Canada. And I understand the reasoning behind that. I understand the prestige of getting into a school that so few get into. But then really, if you're trying to solve for a society being highly educated across the board and not just a select few, you really shouldn't be applauding schools that let in so few people, especially in the age of infinite leverage, where we really can educate a huge number of people with really quality education. I would love to see some of those universities lower prices, but also just let in a lot more students because they actually have the infrastructure to do so now.
So I would actually like to see a lot of the universities that exist not exist anymore, because I think a lot of them don't do their students a service for what it costs. And so they should either lower their tuition a ton or not be in existence. And I actually think the government could do other things that would be much more useful for the world. Just to give you an example that may resonate with you or not, but what if you had 16 to 18 year old kids in high school and you said, hey, you can go join this government program. They're actually going to pay you $500 a week to do this. You're going to learn how to be a computer scientist. And the government also has connections with companies who want computer scientists, like an in-demand skill that these companies need. And when you graduate from the school, in all likelihood, you'll make somewhere between $80,000 and $120,000 to start. And as you go up that ladder, you'll be able to make even more money. how many people would want to be software engineers if that was dangling right in front of them? I think I would have been, at least in my position, because I'm like, shit, I'm like, don't have money and I want to get money. Like, how do I do that? I just thought in my head, I got to get to the best school possible and then maybe I'll figure it out from there. In this case, you give people actual practical alternatives, you train them in a structured way, and you can still create it like a school where there's the social dynamic. It's not just all about practical value. I think things like that, they just don't really exist. You have Lambda School, which is a private organization doing this. But what if the government did this for things like climate change is a big problem? We want more people to learn the science behind it in this way or that way. And we're actually going to go pay people to do that. That to me seems like a good use of funds. And I would happily pay a little bit more in taxes to have people educated in that way.
So these things do exist to a small degree for those kinds of topics like climate change or advancing technology. There are government grants. I, for example, had one in Canada when I was doing battery research. I would also say that this does exist in the United States, but it's the military. So the end goal is not to solve climate change or to be the world leader in technology. It is to be the strongest country in the world that no one wants to mess with, which I guess you could argue has some merit to it. But if I was running America, and I definitely shouldn't be, I think there is merit to this idea that in the past, wars were won through brute force, and that in the future they will be won through technology. So there is an argument that you should probably, as a country, invest just as much in setting up almost like an information military as you should in a brute force military.
Yeah, and one that is aligned with both the goals of the country, but also the needs of companies and the next cycle of innovation. Because just from my perspective, the biggest gap between the people who can earn a high income with relative security and those who can't is largely based on skills. My software engineer friends, they have like a really anti-fragile skill set right now. It's clearly super in demand. We just don't have enough engineers. So if we can tell people early on in the language that would resonate with them, like, you're going to be rich, you're going to be able to provide for your family. That may seem silly to anyone who like has money, but if you don't come from money, that is probably something that's pretty compelling. And I think people actually just don't have that information at that age. And we're really bad at giving that level of clarity.
Yeah, it's insane from my perspective that the United States spent so much money training a bunch of people how to shoot guns or how to, again, physically protect a country. But those skills are so not transferable. As soon as you no longer want to do that or have to do that, you have to completely start from scratch. Versus if you're teaching a large swath of the population really essential technology skills, even if they no longer work for the government, those skills, as you said, are so anti-fragile. They're going to be perfectly placed to continue adding to the economy and driving innovation over time.
Completely. Just to give a little credence to the military, often, like, I've seen it in different professions, but people who come from the military do quite well in corporate settings because they're trained in how to work hard and be a part of the hierarchy, and you can still learn the skills. So I don't think it's a waste of resources or something, but completely agree that you have this like big system set up there. Why couldn't we set it up in another way as it relates to education? My guess is this is just not going to happen. And I think you already see private institutions like Amazon is now doing this. All the big techs seem to be doing this where they're funding educational opportunities for some of their employees. I don't know the exact details of the programs, but they're basically betting on the fact that if their employees go get educated in a specific way, they're going to be valuable enough that it's worth paying.
Yeah, Amazon is now paying for higher education for all of their employees. And I think one interesting parallel to the original conversation of should a person be so rich to be a billionaire? We're now seeing these companies become so big that they are effectively their own jurisdictions. They're effectively a form of a country. I think Amazon actually passed Walmart recently in terms of the number of people they employ, and it's almost 1 million people. That is not a trivial number of people. And then you could also talk about the market cap or the sheer number of resources that those companies have. I think I analyzed this recently where Apple does, I think, $275 billion a year in revenue. And that compared to the GDPs of many countries, I think that equated to the GDP of over 100 countries combined. Now, you can get into the nitty-gritty of how GDP isn't equally comparable to revenue of a company, but the idea of scale here, these companies are already bigger than many countries around the world.
Enter another one-hour discussion about monopolies and what we should do about them. Just kidding. I think we should wrap it up here. We've talked a ton about a lot of different ideas, but let's leave everyone with a few key takeaways. So what are you taking away from this episode?
So I think we expressed a lot of opinions. Hopefully we tried to share some of those opinions alongside some data. But I would say one very simple takeaway is that these conversations, whether it's about wealth inequality, whether it's about billionaires, are really nuanced, very complex. They're not as simple as this is how I want the world to be. But I think some questions to naturally ask as you're exploring this topic on your own, are billionaires even the same? What types of billionaires are there? Which ones do I believe should exist or not? Even if I don't believe something should exist, what would we actually practically do to enforce some of those changes? How do those changes actually impact incentives of people in the system, not just those billionaires, but everyone operating in that system? And even if you do come to the conclusion that we should be taxing billionaires a lot more, there are other questions that arise, like what would we do with those tax dollars? Can we even deploy that money effectively?
That's a lot of takeaways.
The key takeaway is that, again, I think this is a very complex set of problems that are not just as simple as billionaires should or shouldn't exist. I know we started with that question in this episode, but that was one of the key takeaways for me as we started to explore it. How about you, though?
So I have a few. The first is $1 billion is a lot of money. So I love your example of if you spent $1 million per month for 50 years, you wouldn't even spend $1 billion. So we are talking about like tons of money, way more than I can imagine having. But the most important thing for me here is just that I think there's a lot of false associations with the idea of billionaires existing and that being the cause of other problems in the world. I think it's a symptom of a system that we've all agreed is better than alternatives, which is capitalism. And now people are starting to question, is capitalism the best system? Because now we're seeing some of the results of that system. And some people land on, hell no, like we need to go like shift more towards something that looks a bit more socialist. And other people are like, if you go away from capitalism, you've gone away from America and there's not going to be innovation and people will leave. And that's a really tricky conversation. But I think that's at the heart of a lot of things. The second thing is, I think beyond those discussions, which a lot of people engage in, we have to have compassion here around the fact that people are struggling and they're looking for ways to increase opportunities in their life and looking for solutions. And so even if some of those solutions that come out could be considered misguided, I think at the end of the day, we have a problem of increasing inequality. And if you look at history, lots of wars and revolutions and everything else, they start with the seeds of inequality. So I don't think this is a problem that we should take lightly at all. And I think all kind of solutions should be on the table and that everyone should have an equal chance to at least ascend in the world. I don't think the world should look perfectly equal, but equality of opportunity, sure, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. Equal opportunity is something that I think a lot of people, if not everyone, can get behind. The question is just, is there going to be equality of outcome? I personally don't think that a society structure for that is the best. But I also agree that we need to have compassion for people who are being left aside and who are seeing this huge delta between where they are and where other people are in the world.
100%. And I think one thing that the echo chamber that I at least find myself in often of, you know, people in technology is the failure to recognize that people are upset for very real reasons and some people are being left behind and we need to figure out how to make the world a little bit more of a pleasant place if you find yourself falling behind and not able to catch up.
Yeah, I would also caution people who are on either side of this argument to just learn more about the other side and also to play out some of these scenarios. If I was a government official, how would I actually implement new policy? And what would be the repercussions of those policies? The kind of anger against rich people and then simultaneously the anger towards something like capitalism, I think, again, needs to be understood. And we need to be compassionate towards that anger. But I think it gets back to this idea of starting with the root issue. And the root issue for many people is that they don't have enough to live a really great life. And if you start there and ask, how do we solve that? Instead of starting with billionaires shouldn't exist, I think you actually have a much more productive conversation.
Definitely. Couple other key takeaways, just rapid fire here, is I think we should all recognize our biases in this discussion and just consider changing our minds. And one way to do that is the thought exercise that we started going through, which is put on the veil of ignorance. Think about if you were designing society from scratch, how would that look? And forget about where you currently exist in that hierarchy. And I think that can lead you to some new conclusions. The other thing is inequality is increasing, but I don't think that is always at the expense of the poor. Like most of us today have a higher quality of life than we did 30 years ago, even if our incomes don't reflect that. And that's because innovation has led to all kinds of wonderful things where we can now connect with each other across the world. And I won't go on the technology rant here, but I think the world is better today and I would prefer to live today than 30 years ago. Two more points. The first is that not all billionaires are the same. And the same is true for like the rich are not the same. There are, I'd say, like good rich, bad rich, evil rich, virtuous rich, whatever. But to lump all like this group of people who's just like spans generational wealth to like new wealth to farmers to real estate to technology, like it's ludicrous to say like the rich, because at the end of the day, it's like, how did this person get to where they are? Like, would you want to live in a society where you could do the same thing? And then what are they doing with their money? Is that fair? Blah, blah, blah. But I think this idea of lumping the rich together is just absolutely ridiculous and just doesn't get people to the right mind and creates a us versus them dynamic. The final thought is, I would consider, even if you could implement certain policies, can the government enforce them? And then do you trust them with more capital? We've seen like governments printing lots of money over the last year and such. Do you like the way that money was spent? Do you think that there was waste within that? Why aren't some of the problems that are talked about where more tax revenues would come in from the rich solved via all the programs that we've started since the beginning of COVID and even before that? And then the alternative is, do we trust private citizens to be able to allocate that capital? I don't have all of the answers. I've expressed some of my opinions, but I think that's an interesting way to think about this as well.
Yeah, I think this episode just reminds me of why I don't think I ever want to go into politics, because these topics are really complex.
Same. And it's just very hard to talk about them without stepping on people's toes and, you know, having people shut down and stuff. So if you've made it this far, thank you for doing that. Hopefully you found some of the ideas at least interesting, even if you disagree with them. And I think that's one of the themes of this podcast is we want to talk about tough things and do it in a way where we share some opinions, but try to do it in a respectful way.
Yeah, I think on that topic, the reason that some of these topics are not taught in school is because most of the time when you're taught something in school, there is an answer. But for a topic like should there be billionaires? I don't think there is a correct answer here, right? It is a conversation in a very complex world of incentives. So that's the reason that something like this probably isn't taught in school. But I think these are important exercises so that you are not just having these emotionally driven perspectives without actually getting past the surface level of a particular argument.
It depends on who you ask. If you ask Bernie Sanders, he says literally billionaires should not exist. So he might disagree with you, Steph. But I want to end with a quote that I really liked from a tweet, which was from a guy who was recently ousted from a Silicon Valley company for a book he wrote. But he said, the fact the catchphrase is tax the rich and not help the poor is telling. And I actually found that quite interesting because I agree with it generally. Besides the stuff we talked about, like not all rich people are the same. Can the government actually do things that will help us? But at the end of the day here, what we're trying to do is help people. We're trying to create a world with more equality of opportunity. Lots of the disagreements come from how do you actually get there? And that's almost where all of the debate is. But it's important to never forget that it's not just about demonizing and taking down the rich. Like, you're trying to help other people. And if I think you take that frame, you are going to end up with better conclusions and a less narrow lens on the problem.
Totally. I think we should close out this episode, but as Cal said, if you've made it this far, thanks for listening. If you like our podcast, make sure to give it a review, subscribe, all that good stuff. And I guess we'll see you next week.
Just to echo that, if you enjoyed what we had to say, definitely let us know. If you didn't enjoy it, please keep that to yourself. Until next time.
Thanks for listening.